Genesis 3. I'd like to get through as much as we can in kind of the big picture quickie today. That should allow us all to get through verse 15 in review and details on Friday. Now, Genesis 3 is, of course, a great chapter, and part of the problem, as you know, let me do a little eisegetics here, is where you divide the chapters. As we know it in our section, what is interesting about chapter 3 is that it starts with inverted word order, right? Starts with the suddenly, as one commentator put it, or one guy put it, you got a snake on your hands. Where does this come from? And the narrative, which is usually carried by imperfect while consecutives, the narrative really goes back to verse 25, at least for this subsection. Now, that seems to make an odd break with what goes before it, because 25 seems to conclude what goes before it, but the Al-Cain in 24 bring this whole section of the two becoming one, and it's not good for man to be alone. I will make a helper fit for him. Oh, it's a great wedding sermon on the Hebrew preposition kinegdo, usually translated fit. To me, the best translation of, do you know the Hebrew preposition neged, which means over against, opposite? If you're standing on a street and the buildings are on the other side, they're before you in that sense, or opposite where you are. So it sort of means something from the other side that nevertheless creates part of a whole view. That's a beautiful image of a helper. I mean, the best English word I can think of this is the word complementary, with an E. She should be complementary with an I, complementary, but this is really complementary in the sense of complete. And that was the whole idea, that it's not good to have one, but you need two, but the two are really one. All right? I mean, there's tons of, talking about wedding sermons or marriage counseling or sexuality issues that all can play out from understanding this as God's design. But that's all for another day. And then this comes to conclusion, therefore a man will azav, leave, forsake his father and his mother and cleave, this strange word, become close to his ashet, and the one flesh, they will be two, basar echad, one flesh. Be two in Hebrew means to become. So they will become one flesh. Then you have what seems to be kind of just an addition to the end of chapter 2. And the two of them were Erumim. This is you have this coming up later in Genesis 3, but it's the word for naked. Arom. The two of them were Erumim. They were naked, and the man and his woman, the two of them, and not they were ashamed. Bosh in the hith polel, if you want to parse that. I know you're not required for this verse, so you don't really care. But that's what it is, and they were not ashamed. This is kind of thematic. You know, this is really about this problem of nakedness. And the great pun that's coming in Hebrew on this. Now, let me take you one step further back in terms of the eisegetics of this, and that's, where does this narrative begin? I think verse 25 of chapter 2 is the beginning of what we usually begin with chapter 3, because you need that word to get that word. They were naked, they were a room and not ashamed, and suddenly the serpent was a room, which is translated, well, however, yeah, shrewd, crafty, clever, cunning. It's kind of usually in a little bit of a deceitful. There's an adjective in there somewhere. In a deceitful way. I don't have a text here, darn it. Go to chapter 2, verse 4, and you know this great debate over 2:4a. If not, you should. What does 2:4a read? Well, you can read it to me. In fact, if you look at your BHS, you'll see some discussion over the spacing. Remember that the way the page is presented, the lines are presented on the page, is the decision of the text editor. All right, you can go look this up in the Leningrad Codex and you won't see the way the lines are here. So there seems to be a pethuka marker, that's that little P or pay after verse 3, which would indicate a major break between verse 3 and 4. But almost all Bibles, including your BHS, also put a break after 4a. Why is that? Do you know? I'll tell you why it is. It's because 4a says these are the toledoth of the heavens and the earth in their being created. Niphal, infinitive construct, root bara, in their being created or when they were created. In the documentary hypothesis reconstruction of the various sources here, Genesis chapter 1 is part of the priestly source, and one of the characteristics of the priestly source is these toledoth statements. When you get to all the, as we used to call them, begats, called toledoth, these are the genealogies that form a little bit of the structure of the book of Genesis. Now, in every other genealogy list, the formula, these are the toledoth, begins the genealogy. Here, it would seem to end the genealogy, unless, of course, the break comes between verse 3 and verse 4, in which case it begins the next section rather than concludes the previous section. So what do you do with this? By the documentary hypothesis, this is a priestly formula, part of the P source. Genesis 1 and through 2 is part of the priestly document that they learned about after they were in Babylon, and Babylon had an 8-day creation story, and they made an 8-day fit their 6-day scheme by having at least 2 days where two things happened. I'm telling you the sort of standard critical reconstruction of all of this. Therefore, 4a, because it's a priestly formulation, has to go with what goes before it rather than what follows it, because otherwise it isn't a priestly piece. Does that make sense? Yeah. In other words, the split between 4a and 4b is totally arbitrary. And you'll see this in your Hebrew Bible. You'll also see it in all your English Bibles. And it's a break that's obviously not necessarily there if you wouldn't want to divide the verse in half. Now, it seems to me to make more sense that 4a is in fact introducing what follows. Because what you have in the sort of first creation account is this very broad stroke of God making everything, bing, bang, boof, by his divine word, 6 days, everything's done. Now we get to turn, we get to focus. This is kind of a good in Hebrew narrative style where they kind of do one big picture around the block. And now we're going to come at the story a second time and kind of hone in on the details that matter. See? And fill in the details. And the details are the generations of the heavens and the earth and what is described now in Genesis 2. Well, remember that the root of the Hebrew word toledoth is the Hebrew verb yalav that means to give birth, bear. I always say this is as close as you have to a word for history in the Old Testament. And it talks about God's divine history as really having to do with the next generation. This is how God does history. The people of God move forth from one generation to the next. You have children and you bring them up and you teach the Torah, you teach God's word to your children and your children's children, and away you go. That's how you do history. So what we have to do now with this creation, in which there's been placed, at least already in chapter 1, a man and a woman, is focus in on the relationship of man and woman, how they literally fit together, and that can even mean physically, sexually. One is concave where the other is convex, to put it tastefully. But this is, in fact, by God's design, okay, so that they can have children. And this is how God's history of the world is going to move forward But to do this, we need a man and a woman united in a special relationship by which there is reproduction, procreation. Okay, but that's not the end of the story. See, the story gets all messed up in chapter 3, but that's not the end of the story. This part of the narrative extends beyond 3 and includes actually chapter 4, because what finally happens in chapter 4? Sorry, oh dear, we'll have to get that later. What happens in chapter 4? You actually have a kid. And what happens to the kids? They're all messed up. See? So the story of the toledot of the heavens and the earth has to do with God's gift of male and female and relationships and husband and wife and children. But because the fall got in there, even this, from the beginning, from the literally get-go, is all messed up. You see, that's part of this story, of which Genesis 3, then, is one part. It's the key part, perhaps, of what went wrong. But I'm trying to place Genesis 3 into this larger literary context. Now, behind the literary documentary hypothesis to which I was making reference is this assumption that the divine names matter. In Genesis 1, the name for God is exclusively Elohim. In Genesis 3, by the time we get to Genesis 3, what's the name for God? Yahweh Elohim. Okay? Now, according to documentary theory, that's because Elohim is the priestly term, and Yahweh is the Yahwist's term for God. That's why this is called the J source, or the Yahwistic source. And they see these as two different stories that in some ways seem to contradict each other, don't they? You don't have the order of creation, and how'd we get, man and women are described differently in chapter 2 than they are in chapter 1, and I mean, you can go read the commentaries. All right, let's get to the point of the story, which starts with the fact that they're naked. And now you have this pun in verse 3, and the serpent was Arum. Clever, shrewd. More than, did y'all take this as a comparison? Probably more shrewd. I don't know that this is making the point that therefore the other animals are shrewd. Because the focus is on the Nachash and the narrative, because it started the sentence with this in inverted word order. You actually have subject, finite verb without vowel consecutive. That's unusual, right? Ordinarily, you have while consecutive followed by the subject. Hebrew is an VSO language. You know that terminology. VSO, verb, subject, object, right? English is a subject, verb, object language in terms of our normal sentence syntax and word order. Okay, so the focus is on the Nachash, who was so shrewd in comparison to all, and here, whether you take the singular or collective, it doesn't really matter. Every beast of the field, or all the beast things, you can take it collectively, of the field, which he made, here's your normal Hebrew word order, verb, subject, and note the subject is Yahweh God, Yahweh Elohim, which Yahweh God had made, probably a good sense of the perfect acting as a pluperfect, because Hebrew doesn't have a pluperfect. And, am I in the right place? Line 2. And he said, El Ha'ishah, to the woman, Af. Now, we talked about this a little bit. Any questions on Af? Where's the question mark in this sentence? There isn't any. Right? There is in the footnote. I know we talked about this in our section. Dale, did you guys talk about the footnote? Probably not. You don't want to get too distracted by that. But this is one worth looking at. All right, my guys, what does that L stand for? The Latin word lege, which means read. All right, it's the Latin word for read. Lectio, lectionary, all come from the same root. Read, and you notice what they're suggesting you read. Not af, but haaf. What's the hey here? Hey, interrogative. All right, is there a text that has the hey there? No. They're not citing any textual evidence, so the editors is simply saying, you know, this would be a lot better if we had a hey interrogative. Why don't you pretend there's one there? And what's interesting, of course, is that almost all your translations take this as a question. Right? And I think that's legitimate, but not because you have added a hey interrogative, but because of the force of af. Af is one of these sort of interjectory things that kind of means surely, truly. And as I said in my class, I think here's where tone of voice really matters. See, you could say, God surely said that. Now that's a statement, but do you see that's the sort of force, what's called the illocutionary force of that statement, is to create doubt. Surely God said this, right? We talk this way all the time. It's part of rhetoric. So it sort of introduces a certainty that's overplayed almost to the point of it being sarcastic or satirical, in which case it's introducing doubt, in which case you could translate it as kind of a question. Well, did God really say? See, putting a little bit differently. I think, if anything, it's a strong assertion, sort of in the face of God, but one which is intended to raise a question rather than raise a security and certainty, right? Yeah. Well, surely he would do that. See, and we're going, oh, I hope not. It is sure that, or as all translations take it, did God really say? Did Elohim, now what happened to Yahweh here, by the way? Did it occur to you that on the lips of the Nakash, we never have the word Yahweh? When he quotes God, he only gets to say Elohim. See, that's kind of interesting. Did God say, not you will eat from any tree of the garden, right? Any questions translating that? You should have gone through this, and we're just trying to put the pieces together here. Hey, I was just reading, oh, it was around the tower. Somebody, Ben was writing about, Francisco was writing about the botanical garden. There's one. I made the point in our class that this is garden in the American sense of park. But a few places in America use the European sense of garden as a big park. It's the botanical gardens. It's, what are they in London? Hyde Park. Good. Coventry Garden or something like that, see? We call it Forest Park. Jurassic Park. Most people that think garden think of something behind the house where you grow tomatoes or something like that. But this is a big park. Two, any questions on one? But Tomer HaEshah, and the woman said to the Nakash, from the fruit of the tree of the garden park place, no kale, we may eat, right? And here's a good place where the wow should probably be translated, but dealer's choice on this. Remember, and is always just kind of your all-purpose generic conjunction. They don't have a real necessary sense of shifting to but. They do have words that can be contrastive, but sometimes it's just and. Was there a hand in the back? Somebody had a hand up. Yeah. Ah, that's kind of good. Surely God said you can't eat any of these trees. That's not a rhetorical question. It's a rhetorical statement that's begging for a response. Yeah, that's kind of good. See, I mean, you can do stuff with tone of voice that you can't do by just reading the words. But from the fruit of the tree which in the midst of the garden, God said, not you will eat from it, right? Now, this is pretty easy once you figure out the words, right? Not you will eat from it. And then, of course, velo, and not you will naga from it, not you will touch it. Hebrew usually you touch in something or on something. That's just idiomatic prepositions. Now, as you all know, did God ever say this line? I mean, this is one of these little pieces of the interpretation. You go back and remember what God actually said, and he didn't say anything about not touching it. So this is always the Bible class point at which you say, aha, you see. Not only is he creating doubt, he's actually misquoting God or adding something to what God had said. Isn't that what? I'm sorry, the woman's saying this. I'm sorry, you're right. The woman's saying this. So what, she's the one who's misquoting God, right? But she's still, and yeah, the point is still the same. She's getting it wrong. See? So that in her response to what God really said, she's already getting it messed up. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those principles of biblical, it's one of those principles of sola scriptura. Get it right from the Bible. No more, no less. Lots of people want to say less than what the Bible says, but there's a lot of people that want to say more than what the Bible says, too. Yeah. Just right. So this is a woman. Yeah, I got myself tangled up there. The woman's talking and reporting. And by the way, did you notice, how does she refer to God? If this is the woman said to the serpent, from the we may eat from the tree which in the midst of the garden Elohim said. See, Yahweh's already dropped out of her referential world to God. Interesting. Does this say something about the relationship? See, Yahweh is the personal name of God, right? This is, my name's Andy, I want you to call me by a first name. None of this professor, doctor, dean stuff. You and I, we're on a first name basis, right? That's what Yahweh means. So it implies a personal relationship with God's people. It's the God of the covenant relationship, see? So not to be on a first name basis with someone whom we're on a first name basis is to say that there's kind of already a distance, a formality that's betraying a relationship or the state of the relationship. See, I've often said, you know, finding out exactly when the fall occurred, it's kind of like that great debate. When does the bread and wine become the body? Oh, it doesn't really become. When does the bread and wine begin with and under the... What's your answer to that question? Well, it's sort of part of a bigger constellation of events, see? It doesn't magically happen at the magic words, but has to do with everything that we're about here. So trying to isolate the point at which, and see, to me, that's just like sin. It's just like junior confirmands in their gol darn casuistry, right? When do I break the sixth commandment? See, I want to know exactly the point. I want to know the line up to which I can go and over which I guess I shouldn't. See? I did not have sex with that woman. The Ten Commandments are annoyingly nonspecific. Right? Have you ever thought about this in teaching a Decalogue? I'm sorry. And it's kind of like if you have to ask the question, you're obviously asking the wrong question. If you have to ask, you don't get it. I'm sorry, I'm making a speech here, yeah. Then not you will touch it, lest you die, right? Timuthun. Any questions on Timuthun? We got a nice nun energikum there, right? Always worthy of praise. With defective spelling, Timuthun. And the serpent said to the woman, Lo moth timuthun. Right? Not moth infinitive absolute timuthun. Surely not, or not surely, you will die. Because Elohim is knowing, interesting use of the participle, God knows that in the day of your eating from it, infinitive construct, in the day of your eating from it, then, here's your main verb, then your eyes will be opened, nifal of pakach, be opened, and you will be like God, or theoretically gods, you don't know. Yoda'u, Yoda'e, I think that's modifying you all, plural, right? Knowing tov v'ra, good and evil. It's almost a proof text, you see, for understanding that Elohim is really singular. And doesn't mean gods, but means one God. With the grammar, yeah, that's always a good principle. It's not uncommon that Elohim functions with singular verbs. Don't we even have that? But look, you know, when he says, which God said, it's Amar Elohim. Amar is third singular, right? Yeah, I think this is a teaching point that sometimes gets lost when all you read is 1 Timothy or whatever Paul says about, they're both in this together. The yous are plural, right? That's your point. And I'll jump the gun here on, I mean, I think one of the issues here, that does go to the relationship of man and woman and the responsibility of the husband to show some leadership here. And part of his sin is standing there kind of going, what do you think, honey? Looks good to me. By one man, sin entered the world. Romans 5. And the woman saw, don't ask me to parse Terah, because I can't explain, I can parse it, it's cow of Ra, right? This is irregular, but it's Ra. It just is. And the woman saw that good the tree to for food, right? And that desirous it was to the eyes. Awa and kamath are the two verbs for covet in the ninth, so-called ninth and tenth commandments. And desirous it was to the eyes, and nechmath, and I don't know how you translate that. Desirous, again, something you'd want. And the tree was desirous to make wise, hifil of sakal. And she took from its fruit, and she ate, and she gave also to her ish. Remember the pun back at the end of chapter 2. She will be called Isha, feminine form, because she was taken from Ish. That's the one flesh. They started as one and they're sort of intended to be one. And once you put them back together again, you're not supposed to take them apart. What God has joined together, let nobody take apart. One flesh. That's why the issue is not only divorce, it's actually remarriage in the Bible. Well, you can take them apart, but once you put them back together with different pieces, now you got to at least ask the question of the Sadducees, right? Which two pieces are going to go together in heaven? We had a little sidebar about that last week in this room. And she ate and she gave also to her ish, Emma, with her. He's standing there, witnessing all of this and doing nothing. And he ate. Now, the other thing about verse 6, to point out how the narrative works, where are the verbs in the first half of this verse? And the woman saw that good the fruit for food, and that something she wanted it was for the eyes, and that desirous the tree to make wise. There isn't an action verb in the whole first half of the sentence, right? He's just dragging out this sort of picture, this static picture of how she's looking at, but nothing's happening, right? She's looking at the fruit, and she's thinking about it. And she's wanting it. And this is growing. And then finally, in the middle of the verse, she takes from the fruit and she ate and she gave and he ate. You get four action verbs, bang, 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 at the second half of the verse. Do you see the point here? How the narrative drags this out, and once she kind of goes over the edge, then there's no pulling back. See? It's just one thing happens after the next. Verse 7, V'tipachachna, ooh, yes, an imperfect third person feminine. How many times do you see these feminines? And the eyes of the two of them were opened, and they knew that Arum they were. Now they were Arum up here at the end of chapter 2. Nothing's changed. They're still naked. What's changed? They were not ashamed. Now, they realize how stupid they look. Right? That was in James on Sunday. You look in a mirror, you see what you get, you try to forget it. But what was the plan? The plan was to become Arum. They wanted to be as clever as the serpent and know good and evil. And guess what? They got what they wanted. Now before they only knew good, now they know good and Ra, right? But the joke here, the joke's on you, of the Hebrew narrative is this. They thought they would become shrewd. I'm playing on the wordplay between a room and a room. They thought they were shrewd. Turns out they were nude. That's an attempt in English translation to do a similar wordplay to what the Hebrew's doing. Because otherwise you kind of lose the punchline here. Yeah. No, well, I think it's actual plus plain knowledge, but yada, there's better words for discern than yada. Being would be discern. Kind of understand more intellectually. Yada means to know, but to know in a full sense, too. I mean, it's not just to, get 100 on a confirmation test. Yada means to really under. That's why it's used for intimacy in a sexual way, too. It really means to have the full understanding of whatever the subject is. So verse 7, any questions there? Oh, they were naked they were. So they tafard, they what does that mean? Sew? And they sewed a foliage of fig. Alay is from the verb alah, to go up, right? Stuff that goes up with trees. The foliage of fig, and they made for themselves little breeches. Loincloths, right? That's what these are. They made for themselves, how is this translated? Skirts? See, again, in our parlance, skirts probably isn't the right translation. These are loincloths, all right, little skivvies. All right, verse 8, and they heard the call of Yahweh God. Suddenly he's Yahweh God again. He's myth halaking in the God. Oh, nice hifil part, hith pael, right? Walking around. That's what, not just walking, but walking around. Or to and fro in the garden. To the ruach of the day. At the wind of the day. And he, the man, hid himself. Nice hith pael, right? The man hid himself and the woman. It's interesting, this is third person singular, so technically this subject goes with it, but the compound gets included in English. We would have to have a plural verb in English, right? The man and the woman and his wife. But I actually think that this idiom suggests that there's a main subject and sort of a secondary subject. The man hid himself, and his wife too. Yeah, that's not bad. Yeah. And see, I mean, I'm making this point, and I'll say it even more explicitly. I think one of the themes in this chapter is not just the fall into sin and blaming the woman, but the man is quite thoroughly culpable in all of this too. Because he isn't doing what he's supposed to do. And that's love, honor, take care of, and take some responsibility for the actions of his wife and the rest of his family, for that matter. From the panay of Yahweh God, panay here is a great case in which panim probably means presence, not just face, but actual presence of Yahweh God in the midst of the tree stuff of the garden. And Yahweh God called to the man and said, lo, said to him, Ayeka. Did you parse Ayeka? This is from Aye, which means where. Oh, I don't have a blank overhead. Aye, which means where, and ka is the suffix for you, right? So it's kind of ayeka. You'll notice that the ka is actually written plain A with the mater letter. Where you? And he said. Eth kol aka, your kol, I shamad in the gan, and I was yare, in the stative, with vowels. Yare was on the quiz. And I was afraid because arom, because naked I was. You know, this is almost a cartoon at this point. And I hid myself in the Nephal. And he said, Mi higid laka, who reported to you that naked you were? Question mark. All right, here's a great sentence to unpack. question mark. From the tree which I commanded you, tsawithi, tsawithika, I tsawad you, le bilti. What's bilti? Negates what? An infinitive construct. And here it is. There's your infinitive construct. It should be katol, right? Your infinitive construct form is katol with a long holem. It's just that it's become proclitic with the next word. You see the little makef that binds them? That makes this syllable closed and unaccented, and the long holem becomes a short kametz katuf. Get that sleight of hand there? So this is the infinitive construct. I commanded you, literally, to not eat from it. To not eat from it. You ate. This is cow perfect. You ate, except that now you've got to put the hey interrogative back in. This is the way to translate hey interrogatives. Lay them aside. Translate the sentence as an indicative sentence. And now bring the question back into play and make the sentence into a question using English style, which is to invert the word order. Not you have eaten, but have you eaten? Get it? 12. V'yomer ha'adam, and the man said, Ha'isha, asher natata imadi, which you gave with me, to be with me. I was better off alone. I thought it was not good for man to be alone. He's saying, I was better alone. He not the tili minha eats va'okel. She gave to me from the tree, and I ate. And Yahweh God said to the Isha, Ma zoth asith. Oh, isn't this exciting? You actually have a cow perfect second singular feminine. Never thought you actually see one of these, right? Plus, it's a third hey, so it's even more irregular. You don't have any vowel at all under that thing. Asith, go look it up. It's right in the book. It's regular form. You have done. And the woman said, Ha-Nakash. The Nakash, he nashad me. Nasha in the hifil. First nun. See the first nun there? Have you looked this up? Nasha means to trick, deceive, beguile. Pretty strong. He betricked me, beguiled me, and I ate the okel. And Yahweh God said to the nakash. All right, I'm trying to rush to the punchline here because we got to translate 3:15. You can work out the details on Friday. Ki asitha, because you have done this, aror ata. This is heavy stuff. This isn't your kalal to be cursed or kind of done dirty. This is damn. All right, it's interesting. No Bible translates this. Damned you are. But you could. I'm not suggesting that the first Sunday from an lectionary, but cursed you are. Makol ha-behema. He was so proud of being more shrewd than all the animals. Now he's cursed more than all, not just the beasts of the field, but the big boys too. Not just the mid-size, but the full size. From all the beasts and from all the mid-sizes of the field, upon your belly you will walk. Well, telek here is clearly in this greater sense of move. Upon your belly you will walk, and dust you will eat all the days of your life. 15. We made it. Gotta quit. Va'eva. You know the noun oyev, right? Oyev is the noun for enemy, all right? It's from a verb that hardly, I don't think, ever gets used, ayav, that must mean to be hostile towards somebody. It's a participle, so it's a hostile person. But here's the noun. So, stuff of enemies, huh? which I think gets translated into English as enmity, not enemy. Hostility. Ashith, I will sheath. Hollow verb, put or place. I will put between you and between the woman. Yeah? And between your Zerah and between her Zerah. A nice review of the fact that Hebrew always uses bane every time it can. You don't say between A and B, you say between A and between B. Between you and between the woman and between your Zerah and between her Zerah. Now we get to the key line. He will yeshuf you, head, and you will shuf him, heel. What does that mean? Well, at least notice this much. It's the same verb. How'd we get talking about this? Was the great stomping controversy or discussion from David Maxwell's presentation last Tuesday on this passage. But the verbs are the same. All right, and all these translations, I remember being taught this. That's why I'm a little sensitive to this. I remember being taught this, and I don't know if this was Old King James. He will crush your head. You will bruise or strike his heel. However you translate, I think shuf means to bruise, but to really bruise pretty hard. One translator translated this batter, pound. I think it means kind of strike to the death. Now, the word death isn't here, and maybe I'm reading too much into this. But he will do whatever we're going to do here that's intended to be a pretty hard body blow with reference to head. And you will do the same thing with reference to heel. Before I make the point explicit that the action seems to be describing the same sort of action, there are those commentaries that argue that this is in fact a pun. Oh man, and Hebrew loves puns. There's another hollow root, shaf, with an aleph in the middle. That can mean more like strike or something like that. There are two interpretations. One is that these are the same verbs. One is that they're different, but they sound alike. See? Now, that's a stretch because this is hard. I think this is only attested in non-Hebrew cognates. So it's not a very strong argument that this is a pun. I think the point here is that they're doing the same thing to each other. And when a snake attacks a man, how does he get him? What's the point of attack? Your heel or your lower leg. That's the way a snake gets you. And when you get a snake, what's the only way you can get him? On the head, right? So in a sense, this passage is saying, this is like two heavyweights going 15 rounds, and at the end of the round, they're both down. See? They're both down. So why is this the first gospel? Where's the gospel in this text? I think it's right here. We have some indication what the outcome is going to be because the real point of this is a curse against the serpent. But it's not real clear at this point in history how this is going to play out. And frankly, in most of our lives, it's still not very clear how this plays out, right? We walk by divine insight more than human sight, right? And on Good Friday, it wasn't all that clear how this was going to play out. See, I think the point here is not simply who gets killed, but who gets up. That's why Easter matters, right? But, I'm giving you a little, maybe over-interpretation on this passage, but just to tickle you into thinking about some of these things. And it all comes back to translating the verbs, because you got to admit this much, they sure look like the same verb, right? Agreed.